Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today's guest is David Mackey, Senior Manager at AbbVie, responsible for the implementation of SAP's Procure to Pay. He was previously the Director of Operational Excellence at Pharmacyclics, a subsidiary of AbbVie. David is a leader in operational excellence with experience around the world. He strives to drive the competitive advantage of companies by pursuing continuous improvement and optimizing technology with an emphasis on building high-performing employees and teams. He thrives in and across different cultures, and his experience has provided the opportunity to travel extensively, attending school and working in many countries, including France, Mexico, Singapore, and Sweden, as well as extensively across the United States and other countries for extensive amounts of time. In addition to AbbVie, he has worked at Roche, Genentech, and others in helping them become more efficient and effective on a worldwide basis. Welcome, David. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, it's been some time that I've been, you know, trying to get you on the show, politics aside, corporate politics aside, but I'm glad we were able to jump over those hurdles. But we've actually known each other for like quite some time. And were we one of those chance meetings on LinkedIn?
Well, we are connected on LinkedIn, but it goes a little further back. You were at a conference and a speaker at a conference. It was surprise, an operational excellence conference. It was focused on pharma biotech, which was right up my alley. I was working for Genentech at the time. And so I asked a question that helped you segue into something else. And so you thanked me for that. And then after you spoke or finished speaking, I went up to introduce myself. So that's where we started. And that's been when you were still stateside and living in the States at that time.
So I'm trying to put the pieces together here. I've been in Germany almost 12 years now. It's been that long. Yeah. And so the pharma, that must have been, I'm thinking it's Philly, right? I mean, that was the pharma conference in Philly. That's gotta be, man, that's gotta be close to 13, 14 years ago. I can't believe we've known each other that long.
Yeah, it's getting close to 15, I would say.
Wow. Now you don't reside in Philly, right? I mean, you're on the left coast.
I'm on the left coast. I live in California and have worked in Silicon Valley for quite a few years now.
Okay. Now, when you were in Philly, did they just send you to Philly from the left coast from California?
Yeah, what happened is that I had recently joined a team, an operational excellence team for Genentech, and I talked to my boss about learning more and diving a little deeper into things, and so I actually proposed a couple of conferences to him, and so this is one we selected, and so they sent me there, and I spent. We had some operations on the East Coast, so that fit nicely. I could make some visits as well as attend the conference.
Great.
As it happens, my in-laws also live in PA, so that's the airport that we fly into often to visit my in-laws.
And I trust you're on good enough terms, right? So
yes, I'm very lucky. I have some very, very supportive or, very, very good relationship actually with my in-laws. Very lucky. Right.
So where did your journey start? I mean, you said, just mentioned Genentech. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they're like, cutting edge.
Right.
But, they're not as old as you and I. So, where did it all start?
Where did I start? Yeah. Well, I think, I would go back to, my childhood, actually, because it's all tied in with international trade and the fact that biotech and pharma are very international, very global. in their, you know, in their operations. So when I was a young kid, I had maps on my wall. I drove my parents crazy with, you know, wanting to get the latest version of the world map. So I would study that when I was supposed to be going to sleep and look at it. But that probably was the start. And then along the way, I was very lucky. I was an exchange student twice. Once in high school, went to Sweden. And in college, I went to Mexico as an exchange student.
Okay.
So that widened the horizon. I got my butt kicked academically in Sweden. So that kind of pushed things along, shall we say. And then my first degree is actually in geography with the intention of going into international trade. And I've got a master's degree in international trade operations. So I joined anything that was international. So I started early on with a company called Bio-Rad Laboratories. And through the course of that, worked in, some sort of international operations, whether it was customer operations or manufacturing operations, whatever it is.
That was a pharma company?
That was, it's kind of a medical device. I would describe it as Office Depot for laboratories. And so they specialized in diagnostics laboratories and also in research laboratories. So very different market, okay. Very different requirements. And so that was really my entry into the biotech, medical devices, pharma universe, if you will. And I loved it because most everyone was either a scientist or an engineer. And so my niche was the ability to work in different cultures, with different cultures, internationally, understood how time zones worked, that sort of thing. the different currencies, because there was a lot of finance projects and challenges. And so I was able to provide some value in that sense. With this first company, I'd worked for them for about 14 years. And through the course of that, I was an expat twice with them, once in Europe and once in Asia. So that just added to my, interest and experience in working in an international, global, if you will, setting.
Now, you'd mentioned earlier, winding back a little bit, that in Sweden, you got your butt kicked academically. Now, that was high school, right, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, that was my senior year of high school.
Okay, so what exactly kicked your butt? And what's the root cause, if we could get to a root cause?
Well, what happened was when they tried to figure out which class to put me in, in the European system, specifically the Swedish system, they've kind of got you on pathways, right?
Right.
And so I was, the way this exchange worked is I replaced essentially my Swedish brother who was in Switzerland, and he replaced somebody that was in the States.
Okay.
And so I was supposed to just go into his chair, take over his bedroom, take over his desk at school, that sort of thing. Right.
You're so, his proxy.
Yes, exactly. So that probably was the first challenge, because they said, okay, well, so this guy's in, he's in natural sciences. He wants to be a scientist when he grows up. How many years of calculus do you have?
And you're a senior in high school. How many years of calculus did you have?
Yeah. So that's how it started. And then how many years of biology? How many years of chemistry? How many years of physics? And I'm thinking, well, I'm very proud of 1 year of chemistry, 2 years of biology, maybe. No physics, no calculus. And then they said, okay, well, what's your secondary and your third language? And I said, well, I was stupid enough to say, well, Spanish is my second language. And I said, and I'm hoping that my third language will be Swedish, right? And so so I ended up being put in several language courses. They were still teaching Latin, and they were also teaching Old Norse because of the roots of Swedish, right?
Yeah.
So by the time I was finished, I was going to Old Norse, Latin, Swedish, Spanish, and English. Because they thought I needed a little refresher in English. So, yeah, so that kind of illustrates how I got my butt kicked.
Right.
I really
but
was
that obviously didn't if negatively affect your transcripts going into university.
No, luckily enough, you know, I accepted the challenge and you know, went with it. It actually was very good because I was cruising in high school. I wasn't really focused on that. I was more interested in music. You know, my senior year, or my junior year, well, actually I have two senior years is what actually happened. And so my senior year in the States, I had, I think four music classes, you know, so I indeed was cruising, but I was having fun. But right. then when I went to Sweden, then it was time to get a little more serious. And,
yeah.
And so I did meet the challenge, I think. And so entered university much better prepared, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, I remember my first year at university, I had my butt kicked also. I mean, I glided through high school, and I was taking a rigorous curriculum, New York State Regents curriculum, with final exams and everything else. I mean, you know, and I would just, you know, smoke them. I mean, you know, the tests, the final exams, they're all in the mid to upper 90s, you know. So I went to, you know, university thinking, you know, no big deal. Whoops, that first semester, it was like, what does probation mean? You know, and it wasn't like I was sitting there, you know, in the frat houses partying it up. I wasn't. I mean, I was just like, you know, a whole different level of
challenge, right?
Effort. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, so I had to straighten that out real quick and learn new skills that actually have carried forward to today. So,
good point.
Before you got to Genentech, where else? Now it seemed like, you know, even though you're in global trade and having a passion for internationalism and globalization, I'll say, for lack of a better term, how did you end up with an emphasis in, you know, pharma biotech?
Well, what happened was that when I was getting my master's degree, you know, I had an internship with a trade company. And this was, again, in the Silicon Valley. And so it was, you know, chips and electronics to support the computer, essentially, industry. So then when I graduated, I went to San Francisco and became, you know, an employee of another trading company, but this was in fresh produce. And, so it was a joint venture between, an Australian and a US company. And so the reason why I think they hired me was because I grew up on a farm, and so I could go, they would fly me all over the place to check the fruit or the vegetables, whatever it was, to make sure that they were quality, that right. they weren't just shipping, you know, their worst stuff. And most of the trade was with the Pacific Rim. So the whole strategy was to ship it first, you know, to, say a place like, Hong Kong, and, Hong Kong had, you know, for oranges, they had certain specifications. And so, they knew sometimes that it wouldn't be accepted, this load of oranges. And, this is all by ship. So there's a little bit of time on the ship. So, that's part of the calculation. But they had three buyers lined up in degrees of quality expectation. So, you know, if it didn't make it in Hong Kong, then they'd go to Taipei in Taiwan, or then Manila in the Philippines. So they had kind of three tiers of grades, if you will.
How long can an orange last on a ship?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's so that was part of the trick, you know. So I was also involved in the containers, the refrigeration. So they were refrigerated, especially if they were nice quality, you know, you would want to, and they were going to peel them and eat them fresh, right? So so that was part of, and so I guess the point I'm making is that this was logistics. And right. So I became involved in how to be better at logistics, how to be a little bit more strategic rather than just tactical. And so I did that for a while, but the joint venture fell apart. And so then I was looking for a job in San Francisco. I had worked when I got my bachelor's degree for a company called Restoration Hardware that people may recognize. And I worked in customer service. So I was customer service, logistics. I was employee number 7 when they had one location. And so I leveraged this to get a job as a supervisor in customer service in Williams-Sonoma. And another name that people may recognize. So I did that for a while, but it wasn't international enough, right? It was very domestic, very U.S. Right. focused, very focused on people that had, you know, the money to play in the kitchen, so to speak. So it was very, very specific group of people. And so I guess the point being that it wasn't exciting enough. You know, it was kind of routine, you know, same old problems. If your mixer's not working right, that kind of thing. You know, you get all the parts for your Cuisinart, one of them broke or something. So I was looking for another challenge. So I joined this company that I talked about a little earlier called Bio-Rad Laboratories, and the whole reason was because this was a company that was very international, and they needed help in developing their global business. And so I signed up as a supervisor of customer service there. So I used the customer service experience to enter a more international global organization. And so part of my thinking was that pharma, you know, medical devices, you know, biotech, they were very international in how they developed products, let alone how they sold their products.
Right.
And so I wanted to be part of that community. And so that was how they got on my target list.
Now, how did, you know, maybe this is outside of your purview, but whenever I think about, especially medical devices and pharma, the various different levels or different methods of compliance from one place to another. Like, yeah. You know, the rules that the FDA puts out are not the same, you know, between the United States and Europe and Canada and Mexico, and, you know, the list goes on.
Right.
So how did you triangulate, or were you involved in triangulation of product to compliance and regulatory compliance?
Well, that was part of the niche that I found, is that, you know, it's one thing to come up with this cool idea, right? And that was the way it was working in those days. They weren't really looking to solve a problem for a customer. They were in the lab, you know, in this case, in the lab, and they found this cool idea, you know, maybe we can sell this. So that was about as far as they got. And then I came on the scene and said, well, not only can you sell it, but you have to get it there. And, you know, all the details in that we put into product development, a product development process. And so we would, you know, alter, say, even the containers based on where we were going to send something. Because let's say if you were going to sell in China, they have different size trucks. Right. When you're talking about equipment, right? Different size trucks than the trucks that are here in the States. So we had to change, you know, the pallets, right. Because in some cases these pieces of equipment were quite large. In some cases they were very small, so that wasn't the issue. But we were also shipping and selling things that were needed to be kept at minus 70 Celsius or minus 30 Celsius.
So sort of like the Pfizer COVID vaccine had to be like super cooled, super refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
And adds a level of complexity to the logistics, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And not only that, some of them were hazardous material. And so right. To your point, that does vary by destination, you know, how they want to, you know, manage it. How do they want to be informed?
Right.
You know, it's even the language. You know, what language do you use to inform somebody that this is hazardous material that needs to be kept at minus 70?
Right.
So that was part of the niche that I was happy to find that I could add some value.
And so you moved you know, from place to place. You've had, you know, jobs at several companies. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been rolled up into other companies, no doubt. Mm-hmm. You know, what if we fast forward to, you know, last 5 years, what have you been doing now?
So the last 5 years, I've been working for a company that is called or was called Pharmacyclics. It still exists. It's a brand in essence. And it was bought by a company called AbbVie. So I've been involved in the transition, more or less, of Pharmacyclics to the AbbVie fold and their portfolio. And so that includes combining. So I'm still in Northern California, and there are now five sites that are under the AbbVie umbrella. Okay. That we're combining into one. Into, you know, these were separate entities. They were separate subsidiaries, actually.
Okay.
And so we've combined them into one subsidiary. That's what we're actually finishing up this year.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. Mm-hmm. AbbVie owned each of these five subsidiaries already. They weren't acquired. Maybe they were acquired at some time in the past, but they're individual subsidiaries that AbbVie owned. And then there was a consolidation exercise that took place. So all these subsidiaries are going to be under one umbrella. Is that correct?
Right. Yes, that's correct. You got it. So that includes, you know, a system. So we went to SAP. Not everybody was on SAP or the same version of SAP. Other platforms, you know, right. For contracts and travel and expense, you know, all those types of things. So that's been the other part of this transition, as well as changing the organization, you know, restructuring to support this different scope. What would be another, just policies, you know, process and policies that have changed.
And what's your role now?
So my role is I lead a team. It's based on the SAP terminology of,
right.
Purchase to pay, the purchase to pay work stream. And so we support, you know, the business teams, you know, whether they're a commercial team, a production team, a research team, an IT team. We help them with their purchasing and making sure that, you know, that it goes smoothly for them because, right. You know, this is one of those processes that not everybody does every day. And so, you know, oh, we need to do this. We need to engage a vendor, for a service or material. How do we do that? And so we guide them through that.
All right. So, I mean, you've had a varied career. I mean, somehow you serpentined through it all, from global and international trade to logistics, and I could see that segue. All right. Yeah. Uh-huh. And always in, related to bio and biotech and pharma, except for the fruits and vegetables gig that you had. Yeah. But now you're in IT with purchase to pay. So, that's a lot of adaptation. I mean, how did you find going from one to the other? And I would also assume that, since you're into, the IT side now and business process management through IT, I would imagine that your travels, COVID aside, have been curtailed quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah. So that's definitely the case. But, the interesting thing, first to answer how I got here, I think there is kind of a nice progression to it because when you go to SAP, and those of us that have, been in that kind of deployment, we realize that SAP puts a lot of emphasis and focus, and rightly so, on process management versus function management. They don't want to do away with function management, but they say, okay, there's processes that go through all these functions. And then the other thing that's highly important, but one that we don't normally focus on unless we're in a system that's very demanding, and that's data management. The cleanliness, the accuracy of the data. So that's kind of how I got here, is that through the course of my other operational roles, I was dependent on, these systems and therefore dependent on these processes and data management. So that's how I got into operational excellence, was, how can we implement this? But then how do we continue to improve and make it better? And so that's probably the highest priority for my current role, right, is actually continuous improvement, because this is brand new. And so to your other question, that also illustrates what we're doing, is that we're a global support function. I have these that are not in the same office nor time zone. So we've been working virtually from the very beginning. And this team that I'm leading right now is brand new, was launched in February of last year. We had a get-together, a two-day get-together in February. I'm trying to think which month. I guess it was in February.
February 2021?
2020.
Okay, so this is pre-shutdown.
Pre-COVID.
Okay, pre-COVID, yeah.
So we were very lucky in that, right? Because we got together, got our direction set, had a two-day conference, had some good team building, social time, and then COVID hit, really did.
So your team is spread out, you're saying?
Yes.
I mean, they're not just in California, they're spread across the states, across the world. I'm just trying to get a sense of the geography involved.
Right. Well, I have one employee in Switzerland and one employee in India, and then several in Illinois, one in Arizona, and then about five in California itself.
Okay. So the sun never sets on your team.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the idea, right? Because we're supporting, 24/7 in essence.
Okay.
So when COVID hit, it was kind of like, we just kind of shifted gears, how I presented to my team the opportunity to sharpen our virtual skills, whether that be communication, whether that be managing a meeting, managing a one-on-one, if you will. And so that's how we've really, approached this. And so a lot of the feedback that I've given my team solicited from our stakeholders is based on, how are we doing in this virtual environment? That's not going to go away. Once we get COVID under control, the pandemic is over, we still will be working this way. And so we want to make sure that we have indeed learned, from the experience and move forward.
Right. But you're almost a virtual organization before it was cool, right?
Exactly.
I mean, so the transition of going virtual, you really didn't have to face that transition because you were already doing it. That was your model. But you worked on improving it as the new standard.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, question, the people that were remote, when they were remote, did they physically report to AbbVie offices that were remote, even though your team was dispersed? Were they still expected to go into an office?
In some cases, they were. So the Swiss employee, there is a Swiss office. Arizona employee, there is no office in Arizona. So she is completely virtual.
Okay. But even before COVID, she was completely virtual.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. now, the people that what I'm trying to do is, because yours is a very unique situation compared to most people that I've spoken with, where they had an office and everybody got to, together at the office 5 days a week or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. That was the norm. Mm-hmm. And so when COVID hit, it was dramatic shock on many levels. They had to learn new skills. How mm-hmm. do I work from home? How do I balance this home life with my work life? How do I keep hard blocks? So that mm-hmm. I'm not working all the time. Because, people could have a tendency to work all the time if they're working from home. There's no day or night anymore. It could always just be work.
Right.
So your people must have already had some disciplinary skills to manage that work-life balance, which is probably an advantage that other people did not have or do not have. Did your organization, did AbbVie, call upon you and your team to gain experience as they had to transition to remote work?
Yes. And there's two things I would add to that. One is that we were a mix because the previous, even though they have this somewhat virtual role, some of them were doing this in the office, right? Okay. So they were using their Zoom meetings, but they were just doing it in their office.
Right.
So there was some of that. The other point I'd make is that we had a really good approach. We being the larger organization that I was part of. Of maintaining a culture. And so we actually have volunteers that's part of what we call a care team. And so they have events, social events, that were usually on site. For those that were on site, people could come, right. If they were virtual, employees, they could come on site for these events, of course. But then this kind of, we realized this was very important, especially at this time. It was already important, but even more so now because there could be this disconnect, because of a large group of people that, because we kept hiring. And right. so there were some people that were hired virtually and never met, in person, anybody that they were working with.
Right.
So we would have events, we would have, and it was based on people's experience. So not everybody would attend all the events,
sure.
But there would be a beer and and cheese tasting, for example. Not everybody wants to do that. There was a chocolate tasting. You know, some people don't like dark chocolate. They like a little milk in their chocolate. And so some of those people just decided they weren't going to attend.
Yeah, and well, you have to pair the wine properly, too. You know, when it comes to chocolates, you have to use the right wines with the
right
chocolates.
And it wasn't all about food. There were other, you know, we had other activities that we did, you know, as teams. We tried to mix it up.
Right, and these were all live, face to face events,
yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So I mean, So there was a couple of things that were a little hard to do, like like cooking. So we had some cooking events, and so everybody had their computer by their stove, which was a little, a little dicey sometimes. But everybody was, entertaining a screen, if you will.
Hold it. I said face to face, I meant like physically face to face. You're not talking about physically face to face. You're talking about these cooking events and what have you, remotely, but on the screen. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That's huge. Now that's a huge thing. Okay. Cause I was thinking that somehow, a couple of days a month, you'd get the team physically face to face. That's why I asked about the face to face. But what I'm hearing now is that it was face to face telephonically.
Yes.
Doing events. And very cool. So that's great. How did that work out?
I think it worked really well. We got a lot of, this was kind of how we were able to, so employee wise or team member wise, mm-hmm. we got a lot of really positive back. And I think how that works is that we would have, a representative. So one of my team is on this care team. And so it's represented, very well, with the ideas that people would like. It doesn't come from somebody that's not involved with, and share, some interests. It really tries to, bring in the whole community, if you will.
Okay. So the care team would solicit ideas for these, group events from the group. And then select one of them or several of them and build a bit of a program around it, and then invite people, and they'd show up and participate.
Yeah.
That sounds really cool. Now, is this something that came because of COVID, or was this something, because you were remote before, was this something that you were doing before and just enhanced
it? This is something we were doing before, and it was really driven by the transition from Pharmacyclics to AbbVie.
Right.
And so we wanted to maintain the culture that we thought would be very beneficial to maintain and continue. And so that was one of the ways we did that. It sounds like it's very positive to headquarters, because then they started asking us to participate in other teams or larger departments or site, even though we weren't tied to a site currently, they wanted to, expand this to others in AbbVie. So, it's a success in that way too. And I think it's really helped, when we think about, the social aspect of what we've been through this last year. We believe that this has been very helpful, because, we even did things where we did some charity events, where we included families, where we put together a gift package for a child, all family members were involved, and all on camera, so the kids thought that was pretty cool. I think it has helped. We don't know yet, how effective it is, but case in point, my particular team, I've had zero turnover.
Zero turnover for the last year. Your team has held itself together. which is remarkable compared to, well, every other statistic I've read or heard of. Now, the question I have, because I've been reading, you know, in the various, you know, periodicals and news sources that I read, that as companies are wanting or thinking they want everybody to come back to the office, there's been a mounting resistance to that. Some people are quitting. I read where Goldman Sachs had, you know, like tried to welcome everyone back with having a bunch of food trucks in front of their offices there in Manhattan.
I read that,
And, you know, it's like, you know, almost begging these people to come back. And a lot of them don't want to. I know my sister works for a financial institution down in West Palm Beach. And, you know, she's been working remote forever and they've been, you know, wanting now people to come back for the office. And she's like, why? I'm so much more productive, you know, not going to the office. You know, I'm balancing my work life. I'm getting everything done that needs to get done. Why do we have to go physically back to the office? If you're a knowledge worker, why do you have to go back? Now, you know, to your point a few moments ago, you're talking about cohesion, team cohesion and camaraderie, you know, culture. And there's a lot to be said for that, you know, face-to-face, you know, human beings are social creatures, you know what I mean? And, and there's a lot to be said for that. I know me personally, you know, March and April and May of last year was painful because I was grounded. Okay. Mm-hmm. I haven't been grounded for 3 months and like, I can't remember how long. And so when the opportunity got in June came along for me to start traveling and engagement, this is June of 2020. Mm-hmm. I jumped at the chance and I've been, you know, pretty much back to normal ever since.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I would manage well, you know, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, working remote all the time. I think that would grate on my nerves after a while.
Yeah. Yeah. It is challenging. I think, you know, I feel like I'm pretty lucky in my own situation. You know, I live, in a place where I can go for, you know, I schedule in a walk, every day.
Yeah.
I encourage my team to do that. You know, they don't have to go for a walk, but, you know, give yourself time to get up and not stare at the screen, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that helps. I also live in an area where I'm pretty close to some hiking and I love to hike, so I can do that as well. That goes for some of my team, not everybody. Some of them live in, you know, in a city, and it's not quite the same, of course.
Right, right.
But, you know, I think, and it does vary by site. I did read an article last week. I may have told you about this one, where they interviewed people that were working virtually that normally were not virtual and working in an office. And they asked these people, you know, what's going to happen when you're demanded to go back to, you know, back to the office. And they said, well, I'll quit.
Yeah, that's a
25%.
That's a big issue, man. That's a that's a really big issue. There's going to have to be some, you know, when I was in a, a university, history class. This is a history class I took my first semester, and I actually did pretty good in this history class. It was probably my only one, but it was about American history, and it was called Conflict and Consensus. Mm-hmm. And in it, they talked about a thesis, some new thing, okay, and then it eventually finds its apogee, where it cannot sustain itself anymore. In fact, it was one of the premises of my Lessons from Mount Stupid chapter. Okay. So this unsustainability is realized, and then an antithesis occurs where they say, oh, that, you know, that was a bunch of hooey. That new way was a bunch of hooey. It was not going to ever work. But then, you know, synthesis occurs. And it's like, well, we take the good, we take the bad. There's some reality here, and we build off the reality. And I think that's what we're going to go through, you know, office wise, remote work wise, is that people are going to, you know, see the good, see the bad, try to reconcile it, and there'll be a new way that that is forged. And there's some people that are not going to say, are going to just say, I'm not going to work at an office anymore. I'm not going to spend an hour. I know people that live in Westchester County, New York, they'll commute an hour or more each way every day.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, people talk about liberty, having liberties and freedoms. I don't care who you are. I don't care what sex you are, what race you are, where you are in the world. If somebody gives you 8 hours of free time a week, you've been liberated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm an example of that. I would commute 3 hours every day.
Yeah. See, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely, that's absurd. So, you know, and, you know, but on the flip side, and I got to tell you a little, it's a stupid thing that I do. Okay. I used to have to commute, you know, 20 or 15 minute commute each way every day. Not a big deal. Not certainly not an hour and a half each way, but still. And I work from my house. I have been for years since before it was cool. All right.
Yeah,
and, and I was using Zoom before it went public. I mean, this is, you know, this is, this is how we are. But what I do every morning, and people, you know, my family makes fun of me, is, you know, I will get in the car and I will drive for 10 or 15 minutes. Not particularly anywhere, no particular route, but I just drive for 10 or 15 minutes. And what I'm doing is I'm compartmentalizing, you know, my personal time versus my work time, what I have to do today. And I'm just thinking, you know, I'm driving and not, you know, looking around with my finger up my nose, but I'm thinking about what I have to do today.
Right.
And then at the end of the day, I do the same thing. All right. I drive for 10 or 15 minutes and I put away all of my work stuff in my brain. Mm-hmm. And when I get back to the house, then I'm in, you know, family mode, personal mode.
Right.
And I am really vigilant about protecting my borders. I don't let anybody come in unless, you know, I don't let the family come into work and I don't let the work come into family unless that's been prearranged, you know, to the extent that it can be. I mean, life takes over sometimes. So it's like, you know, you can't control that, but you know, I just, I have to do that. Otherwise I would find myself working all the time.
Right.
'Cause I think my native state is work versus not work. So,
yeah, well, they're take some discipline, and that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
I have to work with my team often to say, I see your light is green. You need to eat dinner or whatever it is that I suggest they do. Right. So I do monitor that and keep after them. They know that I don't, you know, if they take the day off, I don't want them, you know, I don't want to see them. That's why you took the day off. So, but you know, we have gotten a little lax in that, I think. And so this has also been an opportunity that we've tried to take to be very disciplined about our time. You know, these are all salary employees, so they don't have a time clock, but they do provide a service, right? So they do have to be open for business at certain times. But yeah, it is a bit of a trick. And the other thing that's facing us is, you know, and globally, is that it's so different wherever you are geographically. You know, the whole issue, whether it's, you know, vaccinations versus, you know, the policies of the government, whoever's in charge, right? Whether, you know, here it's the county that is in charge. And so, what we've done as a company is we've looked at the roles and we've agreed amongst ourselves, you know, because we're very aware of this, this, tenuous, situation that we're starting to enter. You know, how should we approach this? We need to be very strategic about this because we want to be, strategic in how we retain employees and recruit employees. And it's going to be different by location. So for example, here we've decided in the Northern California area that we will offer flexibility as a benefit.
Right.
So flexibility in, you know, when you work, you know, based on your role. So,
right.
And this is, this is all based on who manages this particular team and this particular right. function. But it's up to us, up to someone like myself, to make the call on how effective can we be in working as flexibly as we can. And then that's mixed in with, of course, the role. So if you're working in a warehouse, you're working in a laboratory, you're working on a production line, there isn't much variability in that other than, shifts. And so we've done that as well, is that we've minimized the amount of people in a laboratory at one time by saying, okay, well, let's switch this up into a shift, which a laboratory oftentimes works that way anyway. It's 24/7. Right. And so, and you only need a couple of people in there depending on what you're doing. And so that's how we've handled that by role.
Right.
And then the county that my office is in, currently has been very strict. So they said, well, if you ask your people to come back in, if you choose to do that, this is, you have to do these safety health requirements. So there's a whole, guideline on that. Right. So there's some investment. So the interesting thing with my particular situation is they've decided they're not going to invest in this office building that we're going to move out of in November anyway, and moving to another building. So they're putting all the investment in the new building.
Right.
So we know we're not coming back, no matter what anybody says, until October anyway, and it's not going to be to the old office anyway.
Right.
The other thing is that this county has required that we track our employees, and, we didn't require that they, so as a company, we didn't require that they get vaccinated. But we do require masks and all the protocol. But the county has required that you track what if people have vaccination or not. So we went through an exercise actually at the beginning of this week where we all had to attest to and show our card and that sort of thing, all virtually, to stay. And, and then there was a big worry about, how are managers going to, are you comfortable as a manager working with your team about this and talking to them about that? And I'm lucky enough where I already knew, they'd taken time off to go get a vaccination, right?
Right.
Or not, they didn't take time off, but they were out of the office.
Yeah.
Right. And so I already knew, where they were. We shared war stories about how we felt after we got our vaccinations,
sure.
So it's, I was kind of puzzled by that question, but apparently there are some managers that don't feel comfortable talking to their teams about that. But,
well, it really is across the spectrum, right? I mean, there's people that will get a vaccine and they'll post their cards, signed cards on Facebook. Right.
Right.
And then there's other people that, whether they're vaccinated or not, don't want to share that information.
Yeah.
Okay. They might even be vaccinated, but they're thinking it's nobody else's business.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. True.
Me personally, I've been vaccinated. I mean, I travel enough that, it just makes sense for me, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to sign up for any federal programs. I won't sign up for a vaccine passport. I know I'm vaccinated. I'm not going to do that because, to me, it gets a little bit too, encroaching. There's it sort does. Of like self responsibility, personal responsibility. And mm-hmm. then there's something, and maybe it's because I'm a bit of a rebel. I mean, everybody knows that anyway. I'll do something because it's the right thing to do. I won't do something because somebody tells me I have to do it. And it's just like with employees, right? You get a team together and you give them some combined vision of the future that everybody can align to and work towards, and they're happy for it. You say mm-hmm. you got to do this without context, without being tethered to a greater cause, and they're like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So it's the rebellious nature in us.
Yeah.
So listen, We're coming up to our time here.
Okay.
You know, I've really enjoyed this conversation, David. Thank you very much for taking the time to put this together.
My pleasure.
I would like to maybe revisit this conversation in like 18 months or 2 years time, maybe get a couple of other people involved and walk through the whole, you know, we're working at the office, we're not working at the office, and see what the challenges and approaches might've been from one to the other. But I do have two questions for you.
Go ahead.
I always, you know, have shoot two questions here. The first is, who do you look up to? Who's your hero and why? I'll wait for that one.
Yeah. Well, probably, you know, this is kind of corny, probably my dad. The way he, the time that he lived through and how he's managed his life. I've always admired his approach and his style, shall we say.
Yeah. I could resonate with that because I am often quoting, you know, my father and his lessons that he gave me as I was growing up, and he didn't even know. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like opening up some event and some conversation that we had, you know, 40, 45, 50 years ago. Well, maybe not 50 years ago. And he'll be like surprised that I remember that. Okay. And the second thing, this might take a little bit more reflection.
Okay.
If you had one do-over, what would it be and why, and what would you do different?
Wow. You know, I don't know. You know, I'm one of those people that, you know, I know I'm never going to make, the perfect decision all the time. I think understanding, you know, what, maybe what I would do over is my approach to, you know, I think where I was born and how I was born, I never understood the advantages that I had until later. And so a lot of the things, you know, I didn't know when it was time to make a decision, you know, that it was my decision. And I also didn't understand that things don't always go yes or no. You know, there's some gray in there. And so, I think, you know, if I look back, you know, maybe I would go back as far as what we were talking about, being academically challenged. I might've paid more attention to that, early on, but I had, you know, this dream that I was going to do something different that wasn't, academic. It was to be a musician. And you know, maybe I don't know if that was the decision to make or not at that time. So
right.
But you know, I can see the way it worked out just fine. So that's where I kind of hesitate saying if I would change anything. I don't know that I could have, based on, and maybe that's part of the question, is you don't know some things when you make a decision or you take a turn or you stay going straight. Right. yeah, that's a good one. I haven't, you know, I have reflected in that way, but I think that that's been my conclusion, is that, you know, how I learned and when I learned things was pretty timely. You know, I can't complain about that. You know, I'm actually happy with the way things turned out. And maybe that's why I don't, you know, there isn't much of a critical thought, you know, looking back because of that.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's a Star Trek, I think it was part of a Star Trek movie, where one of the protagonists or antagonists, the antagonists, wanted to take away Jim Kirk's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim says that, you know, I need my pain. My pain defines me. You know what I mean? And you think about, you know, all of our experiences, you know, from the moment we're born to this moment, this conversation right now, all of our experiences, everybody that, you know, we've touched or has touched us, everything that we have read, everything that we've seen, every sunset, every sunrise has all accumulated to making us who we are today.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, if you're happy with who you are today, then you probably don't want to change anything.
Exactly. I think that's, I knew you were looking for something a little bit more thoughtful, but.
Yeah, I get lucky every once in a while. A little wax philosophically here. So listen, David, I want to thank you again for spending the time with me today. It was a great conversation. I knew it was going to be. Really, really enjoyed it a great deal. So thank you.
My pleasure. I think we often have, if not always, have very good conversations. I enjoy every one of them.
Yeah, they always go over time. Truth be told, whenever you and you and I put on a meeting, I always add a 30-minute buffer to it.
That's good. That's a good sign.
All right, everyone. You've been listening to another episode of State of Readiness. My guest has been David Mackey, and I'm Joseph Paris. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.